Before we get started, just wanted to mention by way of a warning that this show is about a crime, the murder of two children, and there are details in the conversation that are unsettling. By now, surely you've heard the story of Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell. I mean, it would be hard to miss over the last several months. It's centered in Rexburg, Idaho. The two have been accused of killing two of Vallow's children. Vallow and Daybell were active Latter-day Saints whose conservative beliefs about things like the Constitution and the end of times became more and more bizarre. When they were arrested after a nationwide manhunt, they had come to believe the world was full of zombies, that they were part of the chosen people mentioned in the book of Revelation in the Bible. But before all of that, long before the journalist Leah Sottile became interested in Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell, there was another story, also in Idaho, that caught her attention.
This really just insane story, something like I had never heard before, was just in all the headlines of the local papers. It was about two missing children, a brother and a sister, who were not found at the site of a triple homicide in their home. It was just this horrific horror movie scene. And the police realized, you know, when they encountered that scene, that there were these two children that were gone. And no one had any idea where they were. They just seemed to vanish into thin air. Search and rescue teams fan out. They can't find them. They're not in the woods. They're not hiding. I was in my early 20s at this time, and every adult that I knew, every editor that I had, everyone in the community that I worked with was talking about these two kids and where they were. It was this strange thing because it was also the summer that I met the person that would become my husband. We were having this crazy love story at the same time. I just remember going to work and hearing about this horrible missing persons case and then having this wonderful thing happen in my life and trying to hold these two disparate things in my mind at the same time. How could so much be going so well, and how could the world be so full of sadness? The children had been kidnapped by a serial killer who had been stalking the family to try to get to them, had taken them into the thickest of wilderness that I have been in western Montana, and had tortured them for weeks, killing the brother and saving the little girl, Shasta Groney. Miraculously, in July of that year, all of a sudden, in the middle of the night, a waitress realizes that a man sitting at her table is sitting with the little girl that's been missing, that's been in the headlines, that everybody had been talking about.
That poor little girl was slumped down. She wasn't excited about anything.
Dean and her manager called police, and after Duncan was arrested, Dean was the first person to hug Shasta.
Said, "Honey, what's your name?"
She calls the police. The man's arrested, and this insane story kind of tumbles from this 8-year-old girl's lips of what had happened to her.
In the taped interview conducted at Kootenai Medical Center just hours after she was found, Shasta, wrapped in a blanket and holding a teddy bear, appears tired and restless, often resting her head on the side of a chair.
It was just a violence that the imagination couldn't come up with.
Shasta tells Captain Dan Mattos when Duncan, who she calls Jet, kidnapped her and Dylan, Jet told the pair, quote, "There are rules and he wanted us to call him Daddy." Shasta says Duncan first took the pair to a remote campsite in the Lolo National Forest. A week into their stay, Shasta says Duncan accidentally shot and killed Dylan. Shasta told the captain Duncan cried when Dylan died. Shasta says she helped Duncan dispose of his body. Shasta and Duncan spent a few weeks at that camp and moved to another site.
When I heard about the story of Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell, my mind immediately upon hearing about it, two missing children vanished in Idaho. I just immediately thought of Shasta Groney and her brother. And I wondered, were they similar? Could it possibly be that there are this many serial killers in the world in Idaho that would come and snatch children from their homes? And this story of Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell was in a way a little bit more horrifying, if you can imagine, than that case of Shasta and her brother.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I think what Leah Sottile means that this story is more horrifying isn't that the murders were more severe or gruesome. I think she believes there's something more disturbing about the story of Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell because it was fueled by a way of thinking, an ideology she's come to be familiar with. For several years now, Sottile has been writing about extremist movements in the American West, some of them grounded in Mormon ideas or doctrine. She's explored these ideas in work for The Washington Post, The New York Times, The Atlantic, among others. She's also produced podcasts exploring these themes, including one about the LDS Bundy family in southern Nevada. Her new book is called When the Moon Turns to Blood. And she told us the story really took hold in the first months of the coronavirus pandemic. Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell were wanted for questioning, and they were found on vacation in Hawaii, seemingly unconcerned about their missing children.
All of a sudden, the world is locking down. Things are feeling so apocalyptic on a level that none of us could even get our arms around. So I think that on the one hand, people had time to think about this, maybe in a way that they wouldn't have otherwise had the world been functioning as it normally did. Mm. But the other thing is, I think it really tapped into a thing that's common with cases that become sort of a fascination, that there was this beautiful woman at the center of it that could be accused of the most horrific of crimes, which is having some sort of hand in the disappearance of her own children and not being able to say they're okay. And of course, we have this modern moment of true crime forums, of true crime groups, of online sleuths and detectives, people who spend their free time trying to solve crimes. And then you've got Nancy Grace, you've got Dateline. So, you know, for when I came in, I wanted to make sure that I captured this entire milieu, this 30,000 foot view, that it was this hyper-local crime with these people in it. But there was also this press coverage and this, you know, 24/7 attention on this strange case.
Some of the work you've been doing over the last few years has been exploring the fringes of American culture, particularly the American West, these extremist movements, some of which, of course, are inspired by LDS culture. That certainly is what you explore in this particular book. What is it that interests you about the extreme fringes of not just LDS culture, but American culture, or culture in the West?
It's a great question. I love this question. So I started my career as a music journalist. I think this would surprise a lot of people. You know, I would interview bands and I wrote about heavy metal and I would jump in, you know, a van and go on tour and that kind of thing. And I think that what that speaks to is I have always found that I had an ability to speak to people living sort of in non-traditional ways and in the fringes of society. I also grew up with a religious education. You know, I went to Catholic school my whole life. So religion is something, fringe and religion are something that I have a lot of experience with. So I also try to think of my work a little bit less like a beat reporter at a newspaper and more like somebody that's exploring themes. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the thematic elements of my work are explorations of violence, but also the American dream. I think that is something that is deeply interesting. And my work over the years has kind of tried to peck away at the illusion of the American dream, but also what people will do to get it. So I think that this has brought me into these very interesting spaces. And a lot of that changed around 2015, 2016 for me, when in Oregon, where I live, we started to see acts of political extremism that with this case that we're talking about at the center of my book, I just had more questions. I had a lot more questions that I wanted to know about why people would for example, take up arms against the government? What was it about that would drive them? And a lot of times I found that it was some level of religiosity that brought them to that.
So the connection between violence and the early ideas and history and maybe even doctrines of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that has come up again recently with the Hulu TV series Under the Banner of Heaven, based, of course, on Jon Krakauer's book, where Krakauer, you know, tried to draw this kind of through line between, you know, the murders of Brenda Lafferty and her baby and the origins of the church, some of the ideas of violence that may have been present there. Do you think in some ways you're trying to do something similar? Are you seeing the same kinds of connections there?
It's a good question. I think that what Krakauer was doing with that book was very big. You know, there was so much history in it. I felt that in my book, I had to get into some of that, but I think I try to center it more in this modern moment. And I say modern from, like, you know, the 1990s on. Right. So you can understand the geographical and cultural, maybe not norms, but things that are kind of in the wind, I think, in the West. You know, I write so much about the West. That's where I live. That's where I report. To me, it was less important to go all the way back to the beginning to understand it than it was to understand sort of some of these figures throughout LDS history that have fomented conspiracy, indulged a sort of paranoia, and maybe unintentionally, maybe intentionally, sowed that into the populace of the church in a way that is difficult to, you know, put back in the bottle, so to speak.
So in some ways, you're less interested in the Joseph Smith part maybe than you are in the Ezra Taft Benson part or the Cleon Skousen part.
Yeah, and I think it's because Benson and Skousen have come up in my work before. Specifically, you know, I've written a lot about the 2016 armed takeover of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon and the sort of religious ideologies that were behind some of the Bundy family that a lot of people know about from Southern Nevada. A lot of their actions, I had the opportunity to ask them about if some of their standoffs with the government came from a religious place, and they said yes. And, you know, they also carried these little tiny pocket constitutions with them everywhere. Yeah. And I came to understand that those were produced by the Center for Constitutional Studies, which was originally started by Cleon Skousen. So this is just to say that I think that coming to understand the history of Benson, his writings, his speeches, and the place of Skousen in the modern church, that felt more impactful to me because it signaled something that helped me understand some of these more modern occurrences.
One of the things you write is that because Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell obviously weren't saying anything in those early days about the disappearance of their children, that to understand what happened, you say, became this exercise in mining Chad's and Lori's pasts. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about what you learned about their pasts, because it's quite interesting. Let's start with Lori. You've talked about how Lori's upbringing really came at this kind of fraught time in the country, but also in the Mormon experience. Talk a little. She was raised Lori Cox, the Cox home in Southern California. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about what it was like there, because she grows up and her father becomes this. This is probably understating it, but a committed tax protester, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, I have written a lot about folks that come from the Mountain West states that have a sort of religious experience that's very grounded in that place and in the interactions with the government in those states. But Lori grew up in, you know, kind of a California girl, Southern California, San Bernardino area, a religious family. She grew up LDS. She would go to seminary before school every day. But she was also a cheerleader. She was, you know, wearing short skirts and kind of the most popular girl in school kind of thing. Always characterized to me as very kind, though, not like a mean girl, like our, you know, popular understanding in the movies of cheerleaders.
But you say that kindness was kind of a mask. You also mentioned that in the book.
Yeah, and where and when that started to happen is unclear to me.
Yeah.
What it, wh whether or not that was masking something more nefarious from a young age is sort of remains to be seen. But it's around the time that she graduates high school. She gets married very quickly to her high school sweetheart, and her father, Barry, and her mother, Janice, stop paying their federal income taxes. This is, is going on kind of in her, I would imagine, in her junior senior year in high school. And that was a very important thing for me to find because I have written so much about sovereign citizens and people who don't believe the federal government has any power. But to see a man who was respected in his community, he ran, Barry Cox ran for city council. He worked for Beneficial Life Insurance, which was owned by the LDS Church. All of a sudden, he takes this turn and really doubles down on it and does not pay his taxes for many, many, many years. Something that he squabbles with in it with judges in court. He does some jail time. He takes it to a place that means to me he really believes it. And it made me start to wonder how much of that anti-government rhetoric was Lori hearing on a day-to-day basis in her house.
Well, you also mentioned some how some of Lori's old friends joined those true crime sites and chats. And there's this woman named Sandra you mentioned, and she'd said to you over the phone that that Lori had to have cracked. What did she mean? What was the pressure that she believed Lori had caved under? Was it the pressure of being a good Mormon housewife, or the pressure of the sort of political sentiments she was hearing at home? What do you think that pressure was?
I sort of wonder from my conversations I have with Sandra and other people that she went to school with. My sense was they thought that she cracked from the pressure of the kind of woman that she needed to be. It was very clear that Lori was, somebody that could be a model. She could be on TV. She did do those things. That there was a lot on her shoulders to be the best Mormon woman that she could be, being the best of everything. And that was sort of the suggestion I felt like I was hearing, that maybe it got to be too much.
You write in the book that as you were beginning to first cover the story, that you had started to write down these questions that you would, ask if you ever had the chance to talk to Lori. And they're the questions you described sort of as that would help you understand how someone could be so different on the inside from the personality they conveyed on the outside. I mean, she was charismatic and charming and lovely, and there seemed to have been, anyway, some pretty dark inner demons. What were the questions that you wanted to get at? What was that interview that I guess you were sort of fantasizing about?
You always hope when you interview someone that they'll be as honest as they can. And it just made me wonder if it was possible to have an honest interview with her, if she could admit to the first time that she felt like she started living her life dishonestly, when maybe she started having to hide who she really was or what she really believed. Because it's very hard for me to know. I mean, there is this wild history of all of her different marriages and her children, the births of her children, the adoption of her son. There's contentiousness all along the way. And I can't tell if, I think it's one of those questions that when you talk about horrible crimes like the ones she's accused of, you have to wonder, were they crimes that just happened and that it happened before she knew what happened, or was it the sort of bursting of a thing that had been under the surface for a while? So I think that's it. I wanted to talk about that. I wanted to talk about the pressure she felt. We know that she's an extremely faithful woman, but at a certain point, it seemed like that transformed into some kind of zealotry. And I would want to know more about that moment of when her religion became almost overwhelming.
I want to get back to that because I'm really interested in what you identify as, if you even did, of that turning point. Because it seems like, as you say, she had some kind of deeply conservative, orthodox ideas, but they did kind of deform into something else. But let's talk about Chad first. Let's mine his past, as you do. I guess he has a sort of classic Mormon upbringing. He grows up in Utah County.
I mean, he's growing up in Springville. Everyone he knows is LDS. He is, an avid reader of scripture, so much so that even in one of his books that he writes about his upbringing, he talks about how he was driving around with his cousin, and people probably thought they were just cruising for girls, but really they were just talking about scripture. Like he, he's sort of almost hilariously over the top with his affinity for his Mormon faith. What's interesting about Chad was that he is almost compulsive about writing everything down in his life. So I was able to, when we talk about mining someone's past, he did the work for me, by laying it all out. He wrote two memoirs. He wrote a long, list of fictional titles, much of which were biographical. And he would talk about that and say, this fictional story is derived from my own experiences and things like that. So, but yeah, he grew up in Springville. He was born in Provo. He went to BYU. He went on a mission in New Jersey. He came back and he married a girl from his high school and really kind of settled into life there in that area, and was just, his faith was everywhere for him, just as it is for so many faithful people. He would make major decisions in his life because he would say a voice kind of spoke to him. And I think that that voice is very interesting because it's, obviously very common. That's a great way to say, I had an impulse to do something. But in his case, he starts to talk about how this voice would direct him very sternly in kind of these random paths that, obviously come up later in the story.
Well, let's talk about there are a couple of things that are interesting about his sort of development. One of the things you write about is that death is this theme that you say runs prominently through almost everything that he wrote. Even the stuff that he wrote when he was a kid in elementary school. What do you understand about that?
Well, I take it seriously that he death was always such a theme. He wrote a story about it was like a murder mystery that he wrote in the fourth grade, and his teachers loved it. He wrote a memoir about his life working as a grave digger that he paid for some of his tuition at BYU by working as a grave digger in Springville. He's has this familiarity with death. It's something that he's thinking about every day. He shares these strange anecdotes of when, very old coffins break under the machinery that he's using, and he sees like a hand or a foot and stuff like that. So it's a big part of his life, and it comes up a lot in his fictional work that, as I read his fictional stories, as all, many authors, they're in fictional books have people, characters die, but for Chad, they were always in these just really horrific ways. There would and the thing that I found so interesting was that it was never the most faithful LDS people who died. It was their faith that would always spare them, but it was the unfaithful or the people who doubted the teachings of the church or who went against them in any way who paid consequences.
Leah Sottile. Her new book is When the Moon Turns to Blood: Lori Vallow, Chad Daybell, and a Story of Murder, Wild Faith, and End Times. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Listener support is at the heart of KUER. You can easily manage your donation at any time using MyKUER. It's a place for you to update your contact information, find tax receipts, and change your giving amount. Got a new credit card or debit card, or maybe you want to switch to a direct donation from your bank account? Yep, you can do that too. Stay up to date with MyKUER. Log in or sign up today at kuer.org/myKUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Leah Sottile is with us, taking us through the tragic and bizarre story of Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell, accused of murdering Vallow's children. This story became an obsession for true crime enthusiasts, but that wasn't the part that interested her. Sottile covers extremist movements in the American West, and she wanted to explore the beliefs at the center of the story, the ones that may have inspired Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell to kill, for for God. Her book is called When the Moon Turns to Blood. There's another really interesting story that I wanted to ask you about. I'm not sure if it's a turning point, but I guess Ched sort of describes it like that. He jumps from a cliff at Flaming Gorge.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to, I don't know if changed his life, but he has this weird response to it. Talk about this part of his life, if you would.
So when he's a teenager, he goes with a bunch of friends to Flaming Gorge. And, you know, people were saying, let's jump off these cliffs. And he did. And he describes that when he hits the water, all of a sudden, it's like he has this near-death experience where all of a sudden he's suspended in time, sees beyond the veil, and understands that he is seeing into the afterlife or some way. A friend jumps in and kind of pulls him to the side and he's okay. But he very distinctly says that after that moment, he was changed, that he, you know, he couldn't see out of one eye for a few days. He didn't really tell anybody that this had happened. But then he also said that he uncontrollably started reading the writings of Bruce McConkie, of Cleon Skousen, and it was that sort of stopped me in my tracks, because I had so much knowledge of Skousen when I read that. And I actually wrote to Ched in jail. I never heard back, but I said, can you tell me why you think that this supposed near-death experience with your insatiable need to read about Cleon Skousen? I found that very interesting, but I didn't get an answer. But I think that he was very much nestling himself in kind of a new world and a new culture of the church.
But why would he be drawn to Bruce R. McConkie and Cleon Skousen and Ezra Taft Benson and a lot of these Mormon, you know, doctrinaire Mormon leaders? Why would that be connected to him having this near-death experience? That seems I guess I don't understand the connection.
Well, it's exactly why I wanted him to answer, because
right.
I can only surmise.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that one thing that I wondered is that in my experience writing about people so far at the fringes of the church, that I've come to understand that there are these subcultures that really lionize these men, particularly Skousen and Benson. And I wondered if it was giving him some kind of traction within those circles, that he was trying to maybe market his books or appeal, have his writings appeal to people at those fringes. It's really the only explanation that I can come up with, because it is such a random thing to say.
It's interesting. One of the things I'm not sure it's right to say you uncover, but you certainly explore in a way that I hadn't heard, is this this arm of publishing of LDS books, and Ched Daybell becomes a book publisher, Spring Creek Books. He sells a lot of his own work, of course. But what's interesting is this subculture, this kind of discrete economy. Say a little bit about this, because it seems a little bit larger than I thought. And the fact that these people who are writing about, you know, prepping and near-death experiences, it seems like they have these conferences you write about, and they're like celebrities. So talk about that subculture.
It was, you know, I think for me, anytime there's a subculture story is where I feel like I thrive. So as soon as I started to see that there were all of these books, it's not just one or two books that Ched Daybell wrote. It was many, many, many books. And I started to understand, you know, that he had left his job working at a newspaper to start his own book publishing company, that his wife worked for it, his mother-in-law. It became kind of the family business. I wanted to know, you know, where were these books sold? I start to understand that at one point they were sold in Deseret Book, but even more so, they were sold on this series of conferences throughout the Mountain West, some of them, really catering to preppers, bringing together kind of a mishmash of ideas. So you had a lot of people who claimed to have near-death experiences that would talk about those near-death experiences. You had a lot of people who were talking about the Constitution and the White Horse Prophecy as reality. You have people who are astrologers and, you know, selling crystals, much more new age ideas. And then in some cases, you would have people who had been involved with militias, who were at maybe the Bundy standoff specifically. And what I came to understand was that there were a lot of people who would go to these conferences. They would go and sit there for 8 hours, several days in a row to hear from this milieu of speakers talking about, you know, canning on one day and prepping for the apocalypse and waiting for it the next day and hearing about a near-death experience or a vision of from beyond the veil next day. And I'm glad you honed in on that, because I think that that's where this became interesting to me, was seeing that there was an actual economy here, that these conferences cost a lot of money, that they all have special workshops you can pay for, that folks like Chad Daybell realized that they could make a name for themselves there outside of Deseret Book. They could sell to that he could sell to people who maybe wanted to hear more about near-death experiences in a sort of safe space where everyone said, you know, hey, we know we can't talk about this so much at church, but here together we can explore these ideas.
It's interesting. You write about how in 2020 you kind of went down the rabbit hole past afternoons, you say, drinking iced tea and in reading these books.
Yes.
And you sort of lay out the thematic elements. Prepping and survivalism is one. Disasters, LDS scripture is one. Conspiracy as reality is one. Violence is one. And we'll come back to that one in a moment. But it seems like they all had a kind of apocalyptic bent, some vision of a future. Did they all have the same, it seems like they all had a similar kind of end. Is that right?
They did. At a certain point, it became slightly uninteresting to pass the afternoons reading books that really kind of concluded in the same way. But in one way or another, it would often be the plight of a single character whose faith was being tested. You know, I think that's a very traditional literary thing to do.
Sure.
But why I thought, you know, other people are baking sourdough bread and learning new hobbies. But I thought, you know, maybe I should take these seriously as a work of literature and write a book report on each of them to try and understand the worldview that this man is coming from and to see such a similar format in each of them. Yes, it's a person with tested faith, encounters obstacles, has their faith tested again and again, converts people along the way, and is often spared from horrors, you know, riots, invasions of foreign governments, literal plagues. Their faith sort of allows them to glide past these things and in the end be victorious. And the message certainly is, coming around to, you know, being faithful is the way. It's the way to be spared. And it really does kind of speak to this apocalyptic world collapse view that I had seen in much more recognizably extreme fringe circles, like around the Bundys. But I think that what made Daybell's writing so distinct is that each of his fictional books, he would write an author's note or kind of a prologue, setting it up from his perspective as the author, saying, these are visions that I've had, or these are things I've seen, or in my last book, I wrote about a thing that actually happened. So maybe we should take these things a little bit more seriously.
Well, it's this idea of an apocalypse coming. It's where the title of the book comes from, in the book of Revelation in the Bible.
Right.
You know, when the moon turns to blood, that's a sign of the end times. The earth will consume itself and only certain chosen people will be preserved. And Chad and Lori and some of the others believed they were the chosen. That's where that fits.
Yeah. And I think I saw Daybell's books as, in a way, Book of Revelation fan fiction. Yeah. You know, it's like someone who is so into a thing that they want to spin off their own storylines. And what's just interesting to me is that there was a market there of people who wanted to buy those books and who thought, hang on, this guy's onto something. I want to go travel to hear him speak, which is what Lori Vallow did the first time that she met him.
Yeah. How do you account for the violence?
In the books or in real life?
Not in real life, although we can make that connection. But it seems like, so I get the prepping part and the disasters and the conspiracy part, but the violence part and the fact that it, I mean, that's the reason we're talking about it, right? Mm-hmm. Is it, it does, it has, now we need to remind ourselves that Lori and Chad are both only accused of these crimes, but there is violence in the accusation of the story, right? So, mm-hmm. so how do you account for the fact that violence is such a part, that you get to a point where your worship, your sense of the end of the world, the part that you're playing, your identity in this story or this universe you've created justifies violence?
I think that the violence puts Daybell specifically, his discussion of violence, his use of violence in his book. You know, he could have written books that didn't have the level of violence that they did. I mean, at one point, his book was removed from the shelves of Deseret Book for a violent scene. So it was concerning to people there that was a factor. And Daybell himself said, you know, well, what does this say? You know, what does this say about, you know, and essentially freedom of speech if I can't say these things. But I think what it does is, this is where I feel like I could place him in a different world, in a world that really doesn't have a lot to do with faith, but that has to do with the violent fringe extreme groups in America that you often hear. I've had, you know, people in far right militia groups. I've had, you know, sovereign citizens sort of always dangle this threat out there that if things don't go the way that we want them to, well, then people will pay. You know, we will rise up. We will have a civil war. We will storm the Capitol. All bets are off. And that's what I was seeing in Daybell, was that he was a character that I feel like a lot of people could understand until that turn. But because of his expressed interest in Skousen, which is shared by many of these groups I'm talking about, I think it put him more in this, well, if things don't go the way that we want them to, we'll do just about anything. And that is, I think, when we have, you know, we talked about the sort of braiding together that I've recognized of the Constitution and faith, but when you add violence into that mix, now we're in a different world. We're in a world of potential extremism where people are forcing their own ideas by violence. You know, so I think that's how I can answer that. Why that comes in.
And you do explore a bit anyway about how it was that maybe there could be a through line, you know, between modern acts of violence and the Mormon past, because you write about the hostility and persecution that early Mormons had to encounter. I mean, one of the things you mention is that everywhere they moved or were, you know, forced to move, everywhere they settled, they carried with them a remembrance of that past pain. Mm-hmm. Which doesn't justify any kind of violence, don't get me wrong. But in some ways, it seems like you were trying to get at some sort of way of explaining how they connected. Is that right?
I think that's absolutely right. It was a revelation that I feel like I came to understand when I interviewed Cliven Bundy, that rancher down there in Southern Nevada. And I asked him, were you here when nuclear fallout from the Nevada test site was falling on your town? And his eyes lit up. He'd never been asked that question before. And he was like, absolutely. I remember when everyone started getting cancer and we knew that they didn't care. They didn't care that our town was here. And so it was like, you know, the LDS people went from, you know, Ohio to Missouri to Illinois, and then to left the country only to have that become a state. It was a part of the United States. And then the federal government came in and said, you can't, you know, practice polygamy, and they broke up families. And then to hear that from Cliven Bundy, that in the 1950s, that people in his very LDS town were recognizing this as just one more act of the government telling us we don't matter, that we can't exist. I think that's something that's often very overlooked when we talk about the culture, the unique culture of the American West, is that you have this very large religious group that has really challenged that freedom of religion that has come up again and again in its very short history. You know, I think that you can read Daybell's books as a bit of an extension of that, whether he knows that or not. I think, you know, I think about the lessons passed down in my own family and where those might have begun. Mm-hmm. I think that that's just as logical to say, you know, my great, great, great grandparents, you know, remember the feds coming in and breaking up our family and things like that. And there's a bitterness that hangs on. So I think when I have editors on the East Coast that say, you know, what's that? What the heck is with people out there? I'm like, well, it's actually a pretty complicated answer to say, you know, there are these cultural norms, distrusts, I think, that are in the wind in the West that are really important.
Leah Sottile. Her new book is When the Moon Turns to Blood, Lori Vallow, Chad Daybell, and a Story of Murder, Wild Faith, and End Times. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Listeners can hear KUER on the radio across Utah. Beyond the dial, there are many ways to stay connected to NPR Utah. Enjoy our free live stream at KUER.org. Take us wherever you go with the KUER mobile app. And if you have a smart speaker, find us there, too, by saying play KUER. Explore all the ways to stay connected at KUER.org/listen.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist Leah Sottile is with us today talking about her new book on the story of Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell. They're accused of killing two of Vallow's children. The two were practicing Latter-day Saints whose ideas about the faith had become more and more distorted over time. Sottile's book examines the beliefs at the center of the story. It's called When the Moon Turns to Blood. What do you think the turning point was for Lori Vallow? She is charming, charismatic, effervescent, deeply devout, but then her beliefs, which connect with Mormon faith for the most part in those early days, they just get more and more extreme and they fall further away from actual Mormon connections to the point where she comes to believe she's married to Moroni, where there are these zombie spirits that she had these powers that she could, you know, just with her mind kill her husband she was married to. That, I mean, Chad and Lori believe they're translated beings. They have these seven missions. There are these white camps that in Lori's house, Chad could set up a, I mean, it just goes off. What was the,
right.
What's the point where it just starts to spin out of control?
I think this thing that I recognized was that things started to spin out of control in her life many, many, many years before any of this happened. And I think it was when she was, you know, her second marriage fell apart very quickly. She was then married a third time. This man became the father of her child, Tylee. She had been a single mom for a little bit of her son, Colby, before marrying a man named Joseph Ryan. And by all accounts, their relationship seemed very contentious, maybe even violent.
Yeah.
After her third marriage to Joseph Ryan dissolves, she gets into a many years long custody battle for her daughter, Tylee, and starts to drum up allegations of sexual abuse by her ex-husband, Joseph Ryan. What's notable about this is that, you know, even in some of the Dateline coverage of this case, the mental health professionals that evaluated Tylee over a decade ago still remember this case for how long it went on and how drummed up, they said, that her charges of sexual abuse were, that they seemed that she had created them. So it seemed like there was some level of Lori Vallow becoming really unhinged around that time. She then gets married again a fourth time to Charles Vallow. They're married for quite some time, her longest marriage by far. They adopt a little boy. And the child that they adopt has pretty severe autism. And Charles Vallow travels a lot for work. And she talks a lot in police accounts, body cam footage, a lot of things that I saw about how much she felt like she was taking care of this really high needs child. And she loved him, but it was taxing. And maybe keeping her from the sort of life she wanted to live, which by all accounts seems to be that she wanted to live a very glamorous life with a big house and a, you know, very good looking husband and a large car and, you know, that kind of thing. So I think all of that is like several turning points, several maybe a bitterness toward the world that you see building, that the, you know, beautiful life that I think Lori Vella wanted to have for herself was a lot harder to attain maybe than she thought. That all of a sudden she is a mother of several children, but that's very hard, you know, and she doesn't have stable support through that whole time of a husband. She's in and out of court. So it's a lot of different things sort of building her anger and bitterness. Now, the other things you bring up, how she believes she's a translated being, she can use her mind, you know, to have powers to kill people. She starts talking about people as zombies. This is something altogether new. And I think that what really happens in the fall of 2018, right around the time she meets Chad Daybell and apparently starts getting very, very into reading books about near-death experiences, it seems that that's when she starts to see herself less as a very faithful woman and more like a goddess. She characterizes herself as a warrior, that she is a warrior fighting a battle, and it's a holy battle. And in this mix, she meets Chad Daybell, who also thinks some of these same things. And that's when everything goes off the rails.
Leah, what do you think you've learned about LDS culture in reporting this book? I mean, you have the fringe elements, you have the preppers and the fundamentalists, you have the other side, though, of course, you have progressives and you have liberals and you have mainstream, run-of-the-mill churchgoers. What is it that makes up Mormon culture? Is it all of the above? Have you come to any kind of insights about all of that?
I think that's a question I could only answer so much not being a person of the LDS faith, but what I have observed as a reporter is that it is as complicated and nuanced as any faith. Where I think that the LDS faith remains so unique and fascinating is its very Western geographical center, but also this continual problem that I think that the mainstream church hierarchy has of kind of these fringes it can't quite bat away. I talk a bit in the book how around the early 90s, when around the time of Ruby Ridge and people kind of adopting a really hardcore prepper survivalist mentality within the church started doing mass excommunications. So they started just kind of cutting off whole groups of people and saying that is not what we are about. It seems to me an effort to kind of root out the conspiratorialism within the church and sort of move forward. And I think it was an honorable idea, but I think that it hasn't quite worked, that these fringe groups have claimed a sort of true ownership of what it means to be Mormon, regardless of if the church hierarchy excommunicates them. You know, oftentimes you'll see a fringe group break off and say, no, we're the true church, follow us. And I think that that is what I have learned the most. It's that it has this unique splintering effect, and that seems to be very tied up in what's going on in society at that time. It seems to fill a need for people. And I really try to explore that in the book, where, you know, groups have tried to offer a thing that that maybe people within the church were craving. And one of those in this book is this need to spiritually level up, that folks like Chad Daybell, the near-death experience people, some of these conferences we've discussed, gave something new to make people's faith feel enlivened and enriched in a way, and created and continues to create to this day a lot of, I think, confusion.
Let me ask you finally, something you describe as the heart of the story. You say it's about a societal numbness to death and violence and a fixation on fear, is how you put it. Explain what you mean.
What was very disturbing for me to encounter as I'm reporting this story is to see that all of the violence that happened in this case didn't happen at once. It happened over a long period of time. And it was sold with a smile in some cases by Lori Vallow, where people didn't give her a second look because she seemed so kind and nice and surely, you know, a victim. So I think that that's what I was getting at, that there was this, you know, immediate violence that was overlooked, but it also, you know, Daybell's books and the violence in this case, they started so much earlier than when the deaths happened. And, these conferences that you and I have been discussing, you know, they really speak to a world-ending view, not about how do we make it better, but how do we become the ones that survive the ills of what's coming. You know, I think that we can psychologically unpack that, why that is such a thing in this moment, but I think that it's a part of a spiral maybe we're all feeling a little bit. And you add in people who then, you know, if we're all feeling like the world is in a bad place, but then you add in apocalyptic idea, fringe ideas, and maybe some mental instability and dangerous things, I think, can happen.
Leah Sottile, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
That's Leah Sottile. Her book is When the Moon Turns to Blood: Lori Vallow, Chad Daybell, and a Story of Murder, Wild Faith, and End Times. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, I'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, @RadioWest. The program is produced by Carrie Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. Stephanie Allerton is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.